Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
More than a quarter of female military veterans say they've been sexually assaulted while serving in the armed forces. And with 200,000 women serving in the military, that's a large enough problem to attract the attention of Congress.
Mr. Dominguez, this is an oversight hearing. It's an oversight hearing on sexual assault in the military.
That's John Tierney speaking to Michael Dominguez from the Department of Defense. The Oversight Committee asked to see the head of the Pentagon's sexual assault unit. Dominguez refused to allow her to testify. And that ticked off Congressman Henry Waxman.
What is it you're trying to hide? Mr. Chairman, the Department of Defense has a history of covering up sexual offense problems. And I don't know what you're trying to cover up here, but we're not going to allow it.
The rate of sexual assault in the military is much higher than it is in the general population. You can't hide from that. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It is Thursday, February 18th. Todd Zwillick is here with me, filling in while John is away for a little longer. Good morning, Todd.
Morning, Celeste.
And, you know, the takeaway for me is it's always a tricky issue when you're coming down to military subjects as to who actually has control. How much control does Congress have to dictate the policies of the military?
And in a time of war, the military chafes at being directed by Congress. But this case, they should probably have no choice. Let's get right to some of the stories we're following this morning. Eight out of the ten American missionaries arrested in Haiti are waking up this morning in Miami after they were freed yesterday by a Haitian judge. Eric Thompson, the husband of one of the freed missionaries, says he's looking forward to seeing his wife again.
It's been difficult, but at the same time, God has lifted us up and kept us encouraged and helped us through this.
Also today, the Haitian government is expected to announce its plans for sheltering over a million people left homeless by last month's earthquake. In Afghanistan, we're learning this morning of the arrest of two Taliban officials. One of the arrests was a result of information gleaned from the captured Taliban operations chief, Mullah Abdul Baradar.
Here at home, President Obama is pushing ahead with plans to jumpstart the economy.
Millions of Americans are still without jobs. Millions more are struggling to make ends meet. So it doesn't yet feel like much of a recovery.
Our partner in the New York Times is reporting that the president and the Senate are close to a deal that would create an early warning system for this nation's financial system. A council of regulators led by the Treasury Secretary would look for excessive risk-taking and imbalances by banks. It was the best day for Americans ever at the Winter Olympics with six medals, including three golds. Lindsey Vonn shook off her shin injury to win the women's downhill. Shaun White picked up another snowboard gold. And Shawnee Davis took home his second straight gold in the 1,000-meter speed skating event.
It's my moment. It's my party. I can, you know, like the girl says, she can cry if she wants to. I can party if I want to. It's my party. I can celebrate. I can dance. I can do whatever I want. I earned it.
U.S. now has 14 medals. Next in line is Germany with 10. And as we talked about a few moments ago, sexual assault continues to be an issue in the military. More than a quarter of women say they've been assaulted while they were in service. Democratic Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez joins us now. She's the highest ranking woman on the House Armed Services Committee. Welcome to the program, Congresswoman. Do you think recruiting methods have contributed to this problem?
I think when we look at recruiting, we have to figure out if there is some way in which we can see that propensity. Now, one of the problems, as you know, that we've had in recent years when we were competing for people, when we needed more people to come into our military because many did not want to come because we are in two full-blown wars, is that, you know, recruiters would do almost anything to get somebody in, and they weren't looking, they weren't even looking at the fact that some of these people may have been alleged rapists. So we need to do a better job of what we're doing when we're recruiting also.
Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Looking at the markets, the Dow will start at 10,309. S&P opens at 1,099 and the NASDAQ at 2,226. Futures are mixed.
Oh, sorry, Celeste. Also this morning, we're looking at programs that want to have kids graduate early so that they can go to college. What about the 11th graders you know? Do you know any 15-year-olds who would be good for college? 8778-MY-TAKE.
Female service members have been testifying this month before Congress on the subject of sexual assault in the military. More than a quarter of women say they've been sexually assaulted or raped while they were serving. We're back now with Democratic Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. She sits on the House Armed Services Committee and represents the Anaheim area in California. Welcome again to the program, Congresswoman.
Thank you.
Representative, I wanted to start the interview by playing a clip from your colleague, Representative Jane Harman, and she's talking about a number of very striking cases of rape in the armed services.
A female military recruit is pinned down at knife point and raped repeatedly in her barracks. During a routine gynecological exam, a female soldier is attacked and raped by her military physician. Yet another young soldier, still adapting to life in a war zone, is raped by her commanding officer. Afraid for her standing in her unit, she feels she has nowhere to turn.
Representative Sanchez, are these typical stories that you're hearing as you look into this issue?
Well, those are not the typical stories, although we've heard of plenty of doctors who hit on or sexually harass or in some cases rape our military women. The more common issue is a lot of harassment, and in particular in deployment overseas, our military women being raped by our military men quite a bit, usually in the evening. You know, we have a policy, and we've had for several years now, that women must go in the buddy system to the restroom. Most women will not go to the restroom at night because that's when most of the attacks are happening, for example, in the combat arena.
They're being attacked by their fellow soldiers and sometimes even their officers of higher rank. And that's a sad comment on the state of our military when they have to go to the bathroom with a buddy because they can't feel safe.
Not only do they have to go with a buddy, they're commanded to. In other words, the commanders know. They know that these women are being raped. And by the way, once you're identified as someone to have been raped, word gets around, and then you're raped more often. And so you just have a really tough time coming back into the unit. Most times you're discharged, or if you decide to go through the prosecution process, it's very difficult. We just had a hearing where there was an alleged rape. And then the next category was, okay, what was the dispensation? What happened? And then it would say the guy committed rape. And then the next thing was, okay, what happened to this person? And it says, oh, this person was demoted, or this person was sent to another unit. I mean, that's ridiculous. We need to prosecute these people and put them behind bars.
The BBC is actually working on a series that focuses on women in the military, and they spoke to one woman who served in the Air Force in 2006, and she herself was assaulted. Here's what she had to say.
You're supposed to carry your weapon at all times when you're in a combat zone. And I put my weapon down and walked away to go smoke a cigarette. And that's when I was attacked. I felt like if I kept my weapon, maybe I would have been able to do something. Maybe I would have been able to prevent it. No punitive actions were taken against him. It would be my word against his.
So, Representative Sanchez, when you speak with military personnel about this issue and you hear stories like that, what do they say when they hear a soldier saying, I wish I'd had my weapon with me?
It's ridiculous. Most women out there understand that if they get raped, there's going to be almost a 0% chance that this is going to be handled correctly. There are three pieces to this whole issue of rape. The first is the culture. This should be a zero tolerance. There should be no rape going on by our military men to our military women. The second thing, we need to have the laws that actually go after these guys and allow them to be prosecuted. About 4 or 5 years ago now, I changed the laws to reflect the laws that we have for civilians in the United States. Why aren't they using them, and what do we need to fix to get this done? And the third thing is how a woman's treated when she's been raped. Is she going to be backed up in the system? Are people going to believe her? Is she going to be treated the way she should be instead of like this young lady said, I put down my weapon to go smoke a cigarette. I got raped. I couldn't go and tell people I got raped because then they were going to give me demerits and they were going to get me out of the military because I wasn't supposed to put down my weapon. Can you imagine that? You get raped and you can't go and tell somebody about it because you're afraid that person is going to tell you, oh, I got to get you out of the military because you were never supposed to put down your weapon.
I'm wondering how, if you feel like the rate of assault in the military reflects the rate that's in larger society. The BBC spoke with Dr. Kay Whitley. She's the director of the Pentagon's Sexual Assault and Prevention Response Office that was set up in 2005, and this is what she had to say.
Sexual assault is a national problem in the United States. It's not just in the military. In fact, we're told it's one of our nation's most underreported violent crimes. So since we recruit from the society we serve, we believe it's also a problem in the military.
What's your response to that?
I don't know if it's more in the military or less in the military than the civilian forces. I do know that rape goes on throughout our nation, that it's an incredibly ugly psychological attack on a woman. So I wouldn't tolerate it in either the civilian or the military.
My last question for you, Representative Sanchez, you are the highest ranking female on the House Armed Services Committee. Do you feel like there's an understanding with your colleagues in Congress over the seriousness of this issue and the urgency for getting it fixed?
As you know, our Congress is 83% male. There are certainly plenty of men now who have a good understanding, seeing their granddaughters and their daughters, that they would not want this to happen to them. And so there's more of an understanding going on. Of course, the women have always understood this to a large extent. The problem exists when people say, well, men will be men and women shouldn't be in the military. And what do you expect when we make a killer machine? And they've got aggressions and they've got to get those out. And I've actually heard these types of comments from some of my colleagues. That behavior and that thinking is unacceptable. And that's one of the things we have to change in the Congress also.
And that is Representative Loretta Sanchez. She represents California's 47th district. She is, as I said, the highest ranking woman on the House Armed Services Committee. Thank you so much for joining us. I don't know. Did you hear the end of what she said?
I did.
I mean, there's some of our serving congressmen think that boys will be boys. I'm stunned by that.
I'm stunned by it, too. There are, the Congress, as people say, is a reflection of society also, and there are a lot of minds yet to be changed in Congress, just like across the rest of the country.
I still can't help but be shocked by it. For more on the topic of sexual assault in the military, by the way, you heard on the during the interview, we interviewed Marty Ribeiro. She was the young lady we heard the clip from who served in the Air Force and was deployed to Afghanistan in 2006, where she was raped. You can actually go to our website to read a blog posting from her. You can read a chronicle of her experience at thetakeaway.org. Now it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the top headlines.
The head of Toyota says he will consider appearing before a congressional committee looking into the carmaker's recent recalls. Meanwhile, the Transportation Department is getting ready to open another investigation into Toyota. This time it's looking at complaints about power steering in their Corolla model. Yesterday, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood reiterated the message that his department will hold Toyota up to careful scrutiny.
We will not sleep until every Toyota is safe for people to drive.
The head of Toyota had previously said he would not appear at congressional hearings looking into Toyota's recalls. Meanwhile, the White House says it's seriously pursuing companies that try to pass off regular employees as independent contractors. It says the crackdown will yield at least $7 billion over the next decade. Companies who engage in such practices avoid paying Social Security and Medicare and unemployment insurance taxes for those workers.
That's not the only crackdown. The Federal Trade Commission says it's looking into con artists who target the unemployed with bogus job placement and work-at-home scams. It says any ads that promise job listings in return for upfront investments is likely fraudulent. Let's look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, a new report says 8 states are earning an F on managing their citizens' pensions, and we're going to tell you if your state is one of them and why. It's in a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
We got some takeouts now on stories we're following this week. And let's go first to pensions. Pensions took a big hit in the recent financial crisis. There's probably many of you this morning who are listening who are worried about the shape that your pension is in. Well, there's a new report from the Pew Center. It says there are 8 states who've been given an F on their management of state pensions. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. She's been following this story. Louise, what are these 8 states who are actually failing?
Good morning, Celeste. The states are Alaska, Colorado, Illinois, Kansas, Kentucky, Maryland, New Jersey, Oklahoma, and New Jersey has not put money in its pension for 10 years.
Holy cow. Now, what does it mean when they're failing? Does that mean there's just a too large of a gap between what the benefits they're supposed to pay and how much money they have?
So the Pew Center looked at a number of factors. Remember, these are public state workers we're talking about here. And they looked at how much money the state had put aside and how much money it has promised. And these states all had at least a 20% gap on that. You know, they had put less than 80 cents aside for every dollar they had promised. Now, the other thing to keep in mind, you mentioned how the market had fallen. These numbers do not even include the market crash of the fall of 2008. This is using data before then. So the real picture would be significantly worse than this. It adds up across the 50 states to a $1 trillion gap between what our states have promised to pay public workers over the next 30 years and what they've put aside. It's a very big problem.
This is only affecting public workers. Do we have any idea of the pensions in corporate or private corporations?
Right, so companies are required by law to put money in their pension each year, but states and local governments are not. They get non-binding recommendations what to put in, and this might be something that will be addressed given this problem. So companies are in better shape.
Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
All right, let's check in Vancouver. It was the best day for Americans ever at the Winter Olympics with 6 medals, including 3 gold yesterday. Lindsey Vonn started the week with a shin injury, and she's now at this point.
It's amazing. I mean, I've given up everything for this, and it means everything to me. It's why I work hard. It's why I'm in the gym, and, you know, my family's here supporting me, and it's just, it's awesome.
That's Lindsey Vonn at the bottom of the hill after her victory yesterday in the women's downhill. We're joined by Nathaniel Vinton. He's a sports writer for the Daily News. He's covered ski racing in Europe for years for publications like Ski Racing Magazine. Nathaniel, Lindsey Vonn, her bruised shin was the most publicized injury at the Olympic Games, and people were asking at the beginning of the week whether she would even be able to compete.
That's right, yeah, and it turned out that she was able to win the race by quite a big margin.
She crushed him.
Yeah, she did, and it was a really rugged course. It was icy and bumpy, and it had this nonstop terrain the whole way, so it put a lot of stress on that injury.
And she's got another couple of events coming up. There's the combined, there's the Super G. Does this victory in the downhill portend good things for those events? Is she as strong in those other two skiing events?
She is, traditionally. We've crammed the schedule pretty tight over the next couple of days with these events, and that's because the weather was bad for a while there. So whatever aggravation she caused with her race run, we'll find out how much that holds her back in those events. But yes, she's very good at Super Combined and Super G, which are both coming right up.
Right. Now, the women's downhill wasn't just about Lindsey Vonn. Let's talk briefly about Julia Mancuso, took home the silver for the United States.
Yep, that's right. Now, the two of them have been racing together, competing together since they were 12 years old or so. They have very different style personally and on their skis. And Julia Mancuso is by no means a dark horse, but this was her best race of the year, and she really rose to the occasion.
Let's also point out that over at the speed skating track, United States speed skater Shani Davis took home the gold in the men's 1,000. It's quite amazing. Nathaniel Vinton of Daily News, thanks for joining us. For more on our Olympics coverage, go to our website where we have stories from a team of bloggers. Skating blogger Aaron Harris has a post on who to look out for in tonight's free skate. That's at thetakeaway.org.
And our last takeout comes from our listeners. We talked yesterday about some of those crazy ice skating outfits sometimes you see. And we got this email from Jim in Fort Hill, South Carolina. He says, I saw a report on NBC where Brian Williams referenced the image of frilly, flamboyant, and sequins fashion for the male figure skating sport in a very derisive tone. Then during the story of the figure skater Evan Lysacek, they went out of the way to mention how big, manly, and macho he is. I tell you what, Evan had an outfit on last month with straps in his shoulder and chest area that looked like something out of a leather bar. What's up with the attack on fashion? So what if we love each bauble and bangle? If you love it, Jim, I think that's great. Keep sharing with us at thetakeaway.org. You can post your thoughts on anything.
Now, on our site, a few of you have been reacting to our coverage of the administration's funding of the country's first nuclear plant in three decades. Someone called Reindeer Girl posts, the idea of reprocessing spent fuel has been around for such a long time, and it's still a bad idea. First of all, it's incredibly expensive. In a struggling economy like ours, the last thing we need to do is spend the billions it will cost to rev up a reprocessing plant.
And we're wondering what your take is. Do you think nuclear reprocessing is the wrong way to go? Or anything that you have to comment on, we always welcome your thoughts at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can post on thetakeaway.org. Don't forget, tomorrow's Friday, we're going to be talking about who had a good week and who had a bad week, and we had a sad nomination.
I'm Veronica from Oklahoma City, and I nominate my husband for the worst week. He's been unemployed since July and was working towards a job that he really wanted and did not get it after 4 months of process. I vote my husband.
That's bad news. I am very sorry to hear that, Veronica, and for you and your husband. But we take your suggestions for whomever had a bad week or a good week. Don't give up. Give us your suggestions at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Listen in on Friday. We're going to see how they compare to the winners and losers that were picked by our friends from The Week magazine. Coming up, our coverage on the stimulus package a year later continues. We're going to talk about a very ambitious program to revolutionize public transportation. Stay with us for that. Coming up, if I told you that at the top of the headlines is Tiger, would you think I was talking about Tiger Woods? Because I'm not. I'm talking about public transportation. It's extremely exciting. Stay with us to hear about a revolution in public transportation in just a moment. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. We're going to talk more about this in a few minutes. Thousands of road and bridge projects broke ground with federal stimulus money, a fact President Obama highlighted on the plan's one-year anniversary yesterday.
There are those, let's face it, across the aisle, who have tried to score political points by attacking what we did. Even as many of them show up at ribbon-cutting ceremonies for projects in their districts.
This morning, our partner, The New York Times, is reporting that the president and the Senate are close to a deal that would create an early warning system for the nation's financial industry. Meanwhile, in a rare show of bipartisanship, House Republicans and Democrats are expected to announce today that they'll team up to rewrite the No Child Left Behind education law. And a controversial visit to the White House this morning. That's the sound of children welcoming the Dalai Lama to Washington. The exiled Tibetan spiritual leader will meet with President Obama at the White House despite strong protests from China.
Heading overseas now, U.S. officials say the Afghan town of Marja is probably safe enough for Afghan officials to begin setting up a city government. The U.S. Marines say the focus remains on protecting civilians.
Just trying to get back and forth and hopefully win the hearts of the locals and let them understand that we're here to help them.
Now, there is still fighting in pockets of the city. Two more NATO soldiers were killed in firefights yesterday. Also this morning, we're learning of the arrest of two Taliban officials. One of the arrests was reportedly a result of information gleaned from captured Taliban Operations Chief Mullah Abdul Baradar. Here at home, fishermen armed with electric prods and fishing nets are carrying out search and destroy missions near Chicago. Their target is the Asian carp and stopping the invasive fish from populating the Great Lakes. So while state officials continue to argue over whether to close Chicago's shipping locks, the fishermen will do their part, but so far they've come up empty. Let's check in on the markets now. Asian markets are mixed. European markets are up and futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,309. The S&P opens at 1,099 and the NASDAQ opens at 2,226. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Now we continue our ongoing national coverage of transportation and the government stimulus package. We're going to take you to Kansas City today, where there's an ambitious project that hopes to take federal stimulus dollars and then use them to revolutionize public transportation there. The federal money is coming from a program that's called TIGER, and it's funding 51 innovative transportation projects across the country. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announced which communities would be getting TIGER funds yesterday. So joining us again is Takeaway Transportation Correspondent Andrea Bernstein. Andrea, what is TIGER?
Celeste?
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Tell me what TIGER is.
TIGER stands for Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery. And, you know, remember back in the campaign when the president was sort of talking about all the new ways of governing and how money was going to be handed out based on merit? Well, you've got this, you know, big old stimulus package of $787 billion, and you've got this little bitty piece, $1.5 billion. But this $1.5 billion is actually upending the whole way transportation is funded in this country. Because what the administration did is it took applications and it handed them out based on merit. How much would it help economically distressed areas? How good would it be for the environment? And what it came up with is a pretty interesting package of transportation projects around the country. You've got a bus rapid transit, sort of state-of-the-art fast buses in Nevada and in Colorado. You've got a streetcar in Tucson, one in Dallas. You've got light rail in Detroit. You've got bike lanes in Philadelphia and Camden, New Jersey. And the idea of all of these projects is that they're supposed to start to remake the way Americans get around.
I think maybe the federal government wasn't prepared for the huge amount of applications that came in. How many cities applied for this money?
They got actually $60 billion worth of applications from around the country. Many states applied several times over. They gave dozens of projects. So this was a huge, huge, huge response. And one of the things that they're hoping is that by sort of beginning to shift the way people think about transportation funding, that when they get to the giant transportation reauthorization bill, which is either going to come up this year or next, that people will begin to think, okay, we're not going to sort of hand out the way we always have based on congressional district, but we're going to hand out stuff based on a project's merit. And if you look at the whole stimulus and how the funding is being handed out, this is one area where you actually see that it's sort of doing the things that the administration promised with the stimulus, which is that it would not only get money out the door, put people to work, but also start to pave the way, if you will, for the future transportation network
right.
of the country.
Okay, well, let's go to one of the cities that actually won this contest for money, Kansas City, Missouri, and we're joined today by Rodney Knott. He's the president of Kansas City's historic Mannheim Park Association. Rodney, how much money did you get, and was it what you applied for?
Good morning. Kansas City received, the region received $50 million.
That's a lot of money. Is that how much you asked for?
Yes. Basically, Kansas City is unique in that we sit on the border between Missouri and Kansas. And so we applied regionally. So some of the projects are in Missouri and some are in Kansas.
Okay, so what are you doing with this $50 million?
Well, the $50 million on the Missouri side is going to go for, number one, what we call the Green Max bus line. And basically it's an express bus, but it's one that is more energy efficient.
Okay, it uses natural gas, or what do you mean? Okay.
And we also are going to be using it for infrastructure. Sidewalks, curbs, streets, street lights, and a better stoplight system, one that can be coordinated to match traffic.
Well, what are these neighborhoods like that are going to be served by this bus line?
Well, unfortunately, the neighborhoods that are being targeted have been historically underfunded. So they are primarily lower-income neighborhoods in the inner city.
And the bus line is going to help them? How is it going to help them? It's going to get them into work and jobs, or what is it?
Unfortunately, as our cities have developed, things have become more spread out. So transportation for lower-income folks tends to be a little bit more difficult because most of the jobs are not in the neighborhoods they live in. So transportation is invaluable to them not only finding work, but just being able to do daily things that many of us take for granted.
Going to the store, right.
Going to the hospitals, doctor appointments, those sort of things.
Okay, that's Radney Knott. He's the president of the Historic Mannheim Park Association in Kansas City, Missouri. One more question for you, Andrea Bernstein. What about the losers? I mean, there clearly must have been many cities that didn't, mostly cities that didn't get the money that they wanted.
Yeah, there's some grumbling, but what everybody expects is for them to sort of pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and come back next year and try to get more of this money, which, of course, would be delightful for urban planners and such who've been saying this is what the country ought to be doing.
Okay, we've got a podcast from Andrea Bernstein, the Takeaways transportation correspondent. That's at thetakeaway.org. It looks at high-speed railroads and other projects. And it asks the question that if we'll remember these like we remember the Depression-era Public Works project. It's an interesting question. That's the Transportation Nation podcast. You can find it at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much, Andrea. Coming up, in honor of all the silver foxes out there, we dedicate this week's tech segment to assistive technologies for older people. Stay with us for that. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. What kind of person would try to profit from a disaster like the earthquake in Haiti? Well, a BBC investigation has uncovered evidence that criminal gangs have been cashing in on the Haiti earthquake by asking people to donate to bogus charities. They're asking for donations. Usually they're untraceable by bank transfer. And then they say they're going to use them to pay for relief supplies, but they pocket the money. We're joined now by the BBC's Razia Iqbal. He actually tracked down one gang that's based in Spain, and he joins us now from London to tell us about it. Let me ask you about this group that you investigated coming out of Spain. You asked one of the managers of this supposed fund what they were using the donations for, and this is what he said.
We are going for medical supply, mostly the blankets, the bandages, and some drugs, mostly.
So Razia Iqbal, he was lying about all of that.
He absolutely was lying about all of that. I spoke to him on several separate occasions. Each time I would ask him what sorts of things they were going to be sending the money for, because what we tried to do was try and get them on side and try and persuade them to open up a little bit. In order for us to make a donation, we wanted to meet them. We wanted to give them a donation in person, which is what we set out to do at the outset. And he continued to tell us that they had particular projects, completely unsolicited. He sent us photographs via email to show us the kind of work that they were doing in Haiti, the supposed projects. One of the photographs turned out to be of a camp, which they said was in Haiti. But the camp, when we zoomed in on the picture, had a logo of a well-established British charity, SOS Children. We went to Cambridge in England to go and talk to the chief executive of this charity, and he said this is a complete cut and paste job from our website. They've taken a photograph from our website and sent it to you, pretending it's work that they're doing in Haiti. But astonishingly, the camp that they said they were setting up in Haiti was actually from the earthquake in Pakistan in 2005, and not even from Haiti at all.
Well, this clip is from your interview with the CEO of this legitimate charity, SOS Children. This is Andrew Cates.
Really, they're exploiting the victims. So I don't feel that they're robbing me. I feel that they're taking from the mouths of the children that we are trying to help. And that is something which is very difficult not to get angry about.
So once you discovered that this charity, the ME Foundation, was bogus, what did you do?
We then tried to arrange to meet with them in London. They kept putting us off and saying, because they said they had a headquarters in London. We went to the headquarters, an address in London. Turned out it was a news agent's, a shop that just sells newspapers, etc., sweets, that had been there for 20 years. So they just plucked an address in London out of the hat and put it on their emails when they were sending out these spam emails to people all over the world. We then arranged for a courier to send the donation that we were willing to give to this charity to Spain. And it turned out we ended up going to Spain in order to confront them. As soon as we confronted the man who came to pick up the package, he ran away.
He fled from your BBC team.
He did. He fled as soon as he saw us, took his jacket off, dropped his fake ID, which we now have, which we're going to hand over to the authorities in England, and dropped his flip-flops and ran. I've never seen anyone bolt quite so fast.
Razia Iqbal is a special correspondent for a partner of the BBC, investigating bogus charities who are taking advantage of the disaster in Haiti to take money from generous donors.
Good morning, I'm Todd Zwilligan for John Hockenberry. I'm here, of course, with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, could a robot replace a caregiver? We talk tech every Thursday, and we'll look at how developing technology has been designed to help seniors. More on that in just a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. 8 of the 10 American missionaries detained on kidnapping charges in Haiti have been released. They landed in Miami earlier this morning. But Pastor Clint Henry of the Central Valley Baptist Church, where the missionaries are from, says he's still concerned about two members still jailed in Haiti.
We are going to continue to pray and work toward their release, believing that that will come soon as well.
A Haitian judge says he wants to continue questioning the group's leader, Laura Silsby, who remains in Port-au-Prince. Staying abroad, the American military in Iraq has run a reconnaissance flight over Baghdad this morning. They're assessing security in the city ahead of elections in March. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse has been on this morning's flight and joins me now from Baghdad. Gabriel, good morning.
Good morning.
What was the point of this flight going 10,000 feet above Baghdad as you did?
Well, what they're trying to do is to ensure security when it comes to the March 7th elections. We went up in this small six-seater passenger airplane that's been fitted out with very high-tech surveillance equipment. They've got thermal imaging and infrared, so they can really zoom in close down onto the streets of Baghdad. We saw that on the screens there, get up right and close and check for any suspicious vehicles or anything that might be attempting to carry out a bombing or destabilize the elections. Now, this is a mission that's been carried out jointly by the Iraqi Air Force and U.S. Navy pilots who've been training these Iraqi pilots to fly these missions. They fly them right across Iraq, and they say that in preparation for the elections, by the time it comes to March the 7th, the Iraqis will be doing this on their own.
All right. Well, that's Gabriel Gatehouse from our partner, the BBC, part of the subtext here. Of course, 2 years ago, no such flight would have gone above Baghdad, even with a BBC reporter.
1 year later, President Obama says his stimulus package worked.
1 year later, it is largely thanks to the Recovery Act that a second depression is no longer a possibility.
Critics say unemployment remains stubbornly high despite the massive cash infusions. And finally, yesterday was the best day ever for Americans at the Winter Olympics. They took 6 medals, including 3 gold. One of the victors was snowboarder Sean White, the Flying Tomato, who says even though he'd already sealed the deal, he had to include his signature move, the Double McTwist 1260. That's 3.5 spins in the air, and he did that in his final run.
I came here to all the way out to Vancouver to do something amazing. I felt like that was the right victory lap.
White took the gold in the men's half pipe. That's a big snowboard ramp for you and me. And that's the second time that he's done that in a row. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
All right, it's Thursday, and here on The Takeaway, Thursday means technology. Now, there's a stereotype that old folks and technology just don't mix. So senior citizens and robots, could they possibly get along? What we're talking about is new assistive technologies that might be designed to help seniors, not just make him mad or make him confused, not at all. But there's some controversy about this, and we're joined by Nick Tarafranca. He's medical director of Medisense Wireless, which is a spinoff of the UCLA Wireless Health Institute. He develops assisted technologies that increase elder independence and safety. We're also joined by Sherry Turkle. She researches robotics and their effects on people's lives. She's a professor at MIT and author of Simulation and Its Discontents. Dr. Tarafranca, right off the bat, we're all familiar with MedAlert badges and scooters. Those have been around. Those are technologies that have been around a long time. What are some of the most exciting innovations that you see for assisting senior citizens, Dr. Tarafranca?
Yes. Good morning.
Hi,
the exciting innovations that are coming down the pipeline are
devices that will help predict the degree of instability and risk of falling for individuals, as well as systems that will monitor medication compliance, and also to further assist people recovering from the effects of serious illness or injury, such as strokes.
A device to monitor balance and risk of falling, this would be something that would be worn on the person, something like a gyroscope?
The devices that are under development contain gyroscopes and accelerometers, and these people might have heard through science newscasts that these are the same components that help guide missiles today, but these components are now incorporated into a insert that will be placed in the shoe, and also from the Wireless Health Institute, there's a cane that incorporates these components.
A cane that incorporates it. Sherry Turkle, I want to ask you, because a device that prevents falling down, a device that monitors medication compliance, those sound like great things. In my family, my uncle and my mom monitored my grandmother's medication compliance, and I think she was happy to have their assistance and their attention doing it. Is there a risk that these devices replace that kind of attention from kids?
I don't think the risk is from these simple devices. In other words, I think that what technology does is it gives us a chance to ask ourselves if they embody our human values. And I think our values for the elderly should be to both give them increasing autonomy and also increase their sense of connection with other people. And I think that there's always that balance of wanting to give them increasing autonomy, because that makes people feel good, and then also when they need the help to bring in human connection. So these particular devices don't seem to me to raise red alerts of any sort. The kinds of devices that I have problems with are, for example, when you're making a decision about a kind of technology to turn an older person in bed. Do you go for something that's like a spatula on top and bottom that literally flips them? Or do you have sort of robotic arms that you put your arms into, kind of hydraulic arms, that let the person keep the elderly person, let the daughter, for example, or son, keep the elderly person at home with them, and that they can turn with these assistive arms the person in the bed? In the one case, you're treating the person like a pancake. In the other case, you're increasing your sense of connection to them.
That's
how I see the kind of distinction.
Nick Tarafranca from Medicines at UCLA. A lot of the technology that we do see that helps older folks, things like scooters, do improve independence and mobility, and at the same time might have the effect of just making it okay for children with elderly parents to think they're doing fine on their own and go about their own busy lives. Do you see any risk of that here?
Actually, I see a very large benefit to incorporate technology that was just spoken about. From a personal experience with my own parents, I know if you can keep the elderly in their own home environment with their own family, they have a better quality of life, in my opinion. So...
Do you see any of the risk side of it at all, or do you think it's all benefit?
I don't see a significant risk that would harm
all right.
the patient. No.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, one of the things that I was looking at was the stroke recovery video game?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little?
It's a Wii game. Is that a Wii game?
Well, I think you can sort of equate it to a Wii game. What this device is, it's called CMAS. It's a clinical movement assessment system. And what this is in simplistic form is it allows the patient to fully engage a monitor, if you would, and go through a series of exercises that play on a condition known as plasticity in neurophysiology, which basically is a condition that allows the brain to remember where it was previous to the injured state and helps it to repair itself and recover. Studies have shown that by engaging people in repetitive movement, they have a better outcome and faster recovery period following stroke.
Sherry Turkle from MIT, does this stroke assist game, if you will, I'll call it a game, does that fit the mold of what you think is a beneficial technology?
That sounds
sounds beneficial. Where I have problems, actually, are when is in a new trend where you give the elderly robotic dolls as companions.
There is a trend of that.
There is a trend of that.
Sounds they're troubling. What is that?
They're very big in Japan, and they're going to be now marketed here. And in this kind of, it's kind of a sociable robot. And the problem I have with that is there's a kind of offloading. These robots, of course, don't understand anything of what the elderly person is saying to them, and yet the elderly connect to them, often in the absence of other people to talk to.
Without true companionship, and that's part of the risk we're talking about here. Sherry Turkle's MIT professor and author of Simulation and Its Discontents. Nick Tarafranca joined us from UCLA. He's medical director of Medicens Wireless.
There's lots of stuff on our website. We've got podcasts and extra reports and lots of things for you to take a look at on our website at thetakeaway.org. That's also where you can make suggestions for who had a good week or bad week. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.